G'day, I'm Philip Adams. Almost had you. And you'll get your program of choice in just a moment. This is just me, Jonathan Green, saying you might also like the Sunday Extra podcast. We're on the RN website too.
Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, RN's weekly rummage around the tie rack of popular culture, trying to decipher the meaning in all the shapes, sizes and colours.
A lot of blue ones there. Hi, I'm Jason DeRusso and yes, today, fashion and politics.
A prime minister, a man with a blue tie, who goes on holidays to be replaced by a man in a blue tie.
The blue tie became a central symbol in Australian politics this week. An item of clothing highlighting the divide between men and women, left and right. But are Gillard's blue tie comments part of a broader sartorial signalling? And who is it meant for?
And Iceland, a small country with a high profile as a haven for libertarians, pirates and leakers. But how much does it reflect reality? That's coming up on The List.
Well, first to Iceland this week, which was in the news again when Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor who's leaked details of American spying programs to the press, he mentioned he was going to look for asylum in Iceland.
Earlier in the week, he told The Guardian and The Washington Post that he was considering seeking asylum in Iceland because of its pro-internet freedom stance, which is interesting because this is a country that has, you know, less people in it than many, many Australian regional cities. But here it is, once again, punching above its weight in the world news.
Yes, and when you talk about digital advocacy as well, I mean, it's important to note that the Pirate Bay, which is the online file sharing site, has moved to Iceland. They have a pirate party, which has been quite successful. And, you know, you add to this the quirky image of some of its cultural exports, going way back two decades ago to a singer like Björk, for example.
And the Sugar Cubes.
Yeah.
And dozens since then, and in literature, and in theatre, and film.
And you have the image of a very quirky, kind of freedom-loving country. But is this actually the case?
Well, to find out more, we turned to Hawker Magnusson. Now, he's the editor-in-chief of the Reykjavik Grapevine, an English-language news and culture magazine, to find out how Iceland gained this reputation.
Well, you know, I have to say, I was nothing really surprises me about Iceland in the international news these days. It's quite a complicated story, but maybe it's not that complicated. The economic collapse of 2008 resulted in enormous social upheaval. And you might have heard we had what we call the Pots and Pans Revolution, where people crowded the streets and in front of parliament, beating on pots and pans and burning stuff until the government resigned. They didn't say they resigned because of the protest, but it was obvious to anyone who was there. Now, in the aftermath, we were about to rebuild Iceland, and we had some fantastic ideas. You know, the old system we felt had lost its value. It had turned out to be empty on the inside and unfounded. So there was a breathing room for a lot of new ideas, and a lot of people in the election, in the aftermath of the protest and the resignation of the government, several new parties formed, and in those parties were some people who were dedicated to the cause of internet freedom, transparency, so on and so forth. They didn't actually get voted into government, although prominent internet activist Birgitta Jónsdóttir did make it on as an MP, and now she's actually, we've had a second election since then, now she represents the Pirate Party, along with several other internet freedom activists. They actually got around 6% of the vote in the April elections and thus have three MPs.
So that's three seats out of 63.
Yes, three out of 63. They're not in government, but, they're making sure the voice is heard. Anyway, after we got the new government in 2009, people were fired up. They were high on the protests and of getting their way. So a lot of citizen initiatives were founded. The Ministry of Ideas got going, and that was a place where people came and discussed and put forth new ideas, proposing them to the government. One of the things that came from that was the Anthill meeting, which was a crowdsourced meeting to try and determine the values of the Icelandic nations, attended by thousands of people, which, you know, a huge chunk of the Icelandic nation. This, in turn, and also inspired by the Special Investigative Report, an agency called the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative was founded by the aforementioned Birgitta along with a few others and backed by the then government, which is no longer in power. Now we have a right-wing government, which is sure to ignore these matters, unfortunately. And they proposed making Iceland a haven for whistleblowers and making some of the most progressive media reform laws in the world.
So what's going to happen now that you do have a right-wing government? I mean, do you think that these sorts of progressive changes, as you view them, will be actually wound back?
Well, I want to mention one last thing. One of the things to do after the collapse was make a new constitution. And we had a constitution, we had a constitution election, and we had a constitutional council voted in, who then in turn attempted to crowdsource parts of the constitution. So that's crowdsourcing is, of course, a big internet buzzword, and that got a lot of media headlines around the world. Also, media headlines are connected to Julian Assange, who has an Icelandic assistant and hung out in Iceland for a long time. Now, he's a fellow Australian of yours.
That's right, and he wrote in 2010 that he hoped that Iceland would become a new media haven, that it was going to be a kind of launching pad globally for this kind of online action.
Indeed, and all these points converge sort of to form this idea that Iceland was well on its way to become an internet haven. However, it looks like all of this is dead in the water right now. The current government that was just voted in April, of the old power parties, has rolled back the constitutional changes and most of the in the process of rolling back most of the progressive changes made by the then government. So I unfortunately don't expect that to come from it or come of it. But at the same time, I think these are important ideas, and for them to be associated with the nation's parliament, they were in Iceland, and for the world to believe that, a safe haven was forming, even if it didn't necessarily come through, I do think that's important and valuable. And we've seen the Icelandic quote-unquote revolution inspiring people around the world, such as in Spain and other places, and I can only hope that this will, even though it didn't quite work out the way we wanted to, serve as an inspiration for change and transparency worldwide.
Where culturally does this libertarian streak come from in Icelandic culture more generally?
I don't know how you could explain it. Iceland is very internet connected and has been for a long time. I think almost every Icelander has a Facebook page, for instance, and internet literacy and connectivity is rampant. Like almost everyone goes online.
Is that because of the geography of Iceland, the isolation from Europe and also those long, long winters?
Well, that might be a factor, but I think the biggest factor is just that Iceland is a very small country, only 320,000 people currently. So any sort of new gadget or new fashion or trend is very quickly spread among the populace.
Now, of course, before Julian Assange, there was also Bobby Fischer, the famous American chess player who got in trouble with the US law when he broke sanctions to play in Yugoslavia. Now, he ended up fleeing to Iceland. Is this a kind of tradition that's grown?
I wouldn't say that. I would say the Bobby Fischer case was an anomaly. Bobby Fischer came and played in Iceland in the early 70s. And he made a few friends in Iceland. So it was basically a Bobby Fischer fan club who lobbied the government to grant Bobby Fischer asylum. And, again, in a small country, it's actually quite possible to petition your government to do stuff like that. And it seems like they had some connects. So he was indeed granted asylum. And we got to see him ramble and rant his way through Reykjavik streets for the past 2 years of his life or so.
We've spoken a lot about the internet in this conversation, but I'm wondering, culturally speaking, on the ground, if you could talk to me a little bit about the role that Iceland is playing as a country that actually now is host to a growing community of international artists and performers and so forth.
Well, Iceland started becoming a hotspot, I would say, in the late 90s with the breakout of first the Sugar Cubes and then their singer Björk. The Iceland Airwaves Music Festival, going strong since 1999, has focused on fringe and cutting-edge acts in music, importing important artists at the early stages of their careers. So this has definitely contributed to the spread of the word. Yeah, we've had since the, I think, early 2000s, and this coincides with the founding of the paper. I now am editor-in-chief of the Reykjavik Grapevine, which is meant to be a mouthpiece for expats, also serving tourists and immigrants, whoever speaks English in Iceland, basically. We start seeing more and more people sort of moving to Iceland to work on creative projects, just because they think that, you know, they have this image of Iceland, you know, everything comes together again for this. It's the nature, it's the spread of popular and great musical artists that people hear about and identify with. It's also just someone like Björk, who has been very, as an Icelandic artist, I have to commend her. She's been very good at bringing it all back home again, sort of. She records her albums sometimes in Iceland, and that entails employing locals to work on them and bringing in international talent, you know, that she's collaborating with as well. And I think what a lot of people that do come to Iceland, accomplishing stuff is super easy. It's a very small country. Reykjavik has 200,000 people. I guess also the Icelandic work mentality sort of is around that people work in spurts. They just, you know, think, oh, good idea, let's do it. I think that's attractive to a lot of people. The ability to sort of get things done in a quick manner and also spreading the word really quickly.
Håkon Magnusson, editor-in-chief of the Reykjavik Grapevine. And for now, Edward Snowden says he's going to battle it out in Hong Kong. On RN, you're listening to The List, and coming up, Blue Ties. But first, the dulcet tones of ABC 702 Sydney's James Valentine and his take on the subject.
Blue ties all around me, nothing but blue ties do I see.
I invite you to imagine it. A prime minister, a man with a blue tie, who goes on holidays to be replaced by a man in a blue tie. A treasurer who delivers a budget wearing a blue tie, to be supported by a finance minister, another man in a blue tie.
My understanding is that quite a few members of parliament are wearing blue ties today. I gather that Kevin Rudd is wearing a blue tie in Sydney.
If I saw a red, don't know what I'd do. There's only one hue on the menu, oh man.
Like most blokes in the country, I have no sense of fashion. So I rely upon Therese and Jessica to basically buy my ties for me.
Nothing but blue ties do.
Well, it certainly was one of the talking points of the week. Julia Gillard's comments about blue ties sparked a debate that went to some fairly strange places. And while some of us are still scratching our heads about the exact meaning and origin of the blue tie comment, it was a clear demonstration of just how political fashion became this week. Now, Dr. Lauren Rosewarne is a writer, researcher and commentator and a senior lecturer at the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, Lauren.
Hello.
And Fiona Scott Norman is a writer, comedian, DJ, woman about town and a regular visitor to The List. Good to have you back, Fiona.
Hi, Fiona.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Now, let's start with the blue tie. Lauren Rosewarne, what exactly was Julia Gillard invoking when she used the phrase men in blue ties? Is there some kind of political tradition or a historical convention about blue ties? Are there red ties? Is that a sign of the left, of Labour?
Crudely, there's the conservative or sort of more left divide. I think, though, she was going for a more blue for boys, blue for conservative idea. And I think it was quite a crude way to cut through that idea that somehow the blue tie encapsulates male conservatism.
That's something that we've seen quite recently in the whole MasterChef ads, isn't it? The ramping up of that blue.
Yeah, imagine if he wore a pink tie, he'd obviously be gay, because in our culture there's very clear indications of what it means to be homosexual. It's either you're a hairdresser or you wear pink. So obviously the blue tie in this sense was about being conservative and being male.
It was a weird one, though, because for a moment I was sort of scratching my head and thinking it just seemed to me to be almost invoking a symbol of another era. Well, and this is what emerged later in the week, too, that people across both sides of the House were seen wearing blue ties. Fiona Scott Norman, what did you make of it?
I think that what Julia was trying to do was actually perhaps create her own version of the faceless men.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of a way of putting all men in the same basket because, as Kevin Rudd did point out, you know, actually in a very sexist way, saying that men don't have fashion sense. But, you know, basically a tie is a tie is a tie to most guys, I think. And so I think she chose blue also because, frankly, most men wear blue ties. So I think maybe she just sort of like decided to create her own signifier.
Well, she certainly created something because...
Oh, she has.
But it was also to a very converted audience already. I mean, these were women there to support her. It was a group of women. So it was a very easy, I think, metaphor to cut through into that audience. I think it didn't play outside of that audience. I think the rest of us looked on it and were quite confused. But that audience seemed to get whatever it was that she was trying to sell.
Well, they were won over. They were young women wearing T-shirts, basically, with Gillard's name emblazoned on them.
And they were laughing as though this analogy meant something to them. So it obviously worked in that space, not so much outside of it.
This is the Women for Gillard event that was held earlier this week. Whether or not she intended to, she sparked something quite extraordinary. I mean, for me, the headline of the week was Kevin Rudd declares war on Julia Gillard with blue tie choice. I mean, a week ago, if you'd seen that, you would never have understood it. The Daily Telegraph in Sydney ran with a full strap across a double page spread showing every man on her front bench wearing a blue tie and a picture of Tim Matheson, her partner, wearing a blue tie. The Australian went with a different angle showing the five most powerful men in politics and the choice of tie colour they chose the following day. So she's obviously sparked a kind of interesting little war of some kind. But the origins aren't actually that clear because it was Kevin Rudd who last week on the 7:30 report brought ties up.
Mr. Abbott is now saying after 20 years in Parliament, 19 years as one of the most extreme right-wing Conservative leaders or politicians that the Liberal Party has thrown up, in his 20th year, he's suddenly become a policy moderate. Well, you can wear, you know, pale blue ties to assuage people up to some point, but a leopard never changes its spots.
So that's Kevin Rudd accusing Tony Abbott of wearing a pale blue tie. And just a week later, he was the one wearing a pale blue tie.
Oh, he was wearing a saturated pastel, though, I think you'll find.
And there is the idea of blue being a supposedly calming colour in comparison to red, which is supposed to be what you wear when you're going into battle. Women are always recommended in women's magazines to wear red if you have to front the boardroom.
Well, it's also about, you know, being sexually attractive as well. I mean, red is the colour that you wear on your lips because it brings to mind...
red and genitals.
Absolutely, in monkeys. So, and other things. So, I mean, you know,
it's also deeply embedded in the Westminster system. I mean, blue has been traditionally a colour of the Conservatives or the Tories.
But now you've got a question of shades. I mean, in what we just heard there was Rudd talking about a kind of pale blue as being like a touchy feely kind of moderate.
If not insipid as well.
Yeah, perhaps.
Absolutely. Is it like 50 shades of blue?
This is where we're at, isn't it?
Interesting. Now, back in April, Tony Abbott was challenged about his choice of blue ties on Classic Hits 104.3 Nova on Brig and Limo.
The big questions are asked.
This is how he was bailed up.
Now, you're looking as smart as paint today. you're wearing a blue tie. Now, they say blue, is blue the power colour? Or...
Is it? Look, it's sort of my uniform. Dark suit, white shirt, blue tie is kind of my uniform. And I figure if I look more or less the same every day, people won't be distracted by my appearance. They will listen to what I have to say. Oh.
This is something that I thought was really interesting about the Liberal MP, Alex Hawke. He came up with the idea that all the Labor politicians should wear olive neutral plain paper packaging ties in solidarity.
Yeah, there has been a suggestion somewhere around this week that people should go back to looking at Al Gradsby for, you know, maybe a bit of colour and movement in their ties. Lauren Rosewarn, do you think that this tie fest... of the week
is a sign of a too long election campaign. That's what it is. Any angle will be probed at the moment because there's nothing to talk about. Well, there's stuff to talk about, but we're not talking about policy.
Well, that's right. Are the stakes just too high? And so this sort of play.
Oh, and it's also very easy to talk about ties because everybody understands ties. It doesn't involve detailed explanations in the papers. It's very easy to just sell these puff piece stories, and they clearly get traction.
Oh, and it means that they can do things like just spend 5 minutes Googling images of politicians in blue ties.
And create a montage.
And they've got a montage, absolutely, front page, no problem. So it also allows people to be lazy rather than... it takes a lot of effort to actually write a decent analysis of what's going on in the world. So it's much easier if you can just kind of whack together a few pictures of men wearing ties.
Mm. Lauren Roswin, you actually wrote a piece for The Conversation this week talking about some of the politics around the Menugate scenario. Do you think that, and Julia Gillard has often said that she hopes that as the first female Prime Minister, she's just going to normalise that for future women going into the role. Do you think that a whole generation of girls, women, females are going to be turned off entering politics after they've seen some of the kind of discourse around Julia Gillard in the last few months?
Oh, in the last few hours. This morning I have a piece on the ABC's Drum about the Tim Matheson question. And that question wasn't a question about Tim Matheson's sexuality. That was a very intimate question about Julia Gillard's sexuality and about Julia Gillard's femininity and womanhood. And I think that these type of questions don't get directed at men. We don't ask men about their personal lives or make assumptions about their personal lives or question the cut of their jackets in the same way that we do with men. Sorry, with women.
But I mean, I think it's also, I mean, look, it's also just a great opportunity to slag off gay people, really. I mean, the whole hairdresser trope is just so hackneyed. It's just as well lucky for Tim that he wasn't interior designing on the side, like this whole notion that, well, he's a hairdresser, he must be gay, is extremely insulting. And, that's one thing I found about that whole situation was that it was just kind of like a great way to really aggravate as broad a range of minorities as possible.
While simultaneously, I think, working to solidify the kind of audience that loves this crap.
Yeah, of course.
So this feeds into Howard Sutler's style. It's the same as the Alan Jones stuff. These things work for these identities because it builds their brand, because there are a portion of people who actually believe that crap and like that they dare to go there.
Yeah, that's right. Finally, someone's saying what I've been thinking.
This wise equation of hairdresser, male hairdresser equals homosexual.
Well, look, what has been lost this week is any true analysis of Malcolm Turnbull appearing on Q&A in yet another leather jacket.
And a different leather jacket from previous ones. So he's obviously got a wardrobe, well, maybe not full of them, but he's got more than one. And given that there are many casual jacket options that men can call upon when they don't want to appear in a suit, it's quite odd that he keeps going back to the dead cow option, really.
There was a time when leather jackets, though, was all about renegade and cutting edge. That was the 1950s, but still.
Well, there was also a time when they were very much associated with kind of trade unionists and so forth in like the Arthur Scargill sort of 70s days as well. So in a way, he's kind of...
Back to the waterfront.
Yeah, he's kind of appropriating an almost left sartorial symbol, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's also... Look, I mean, okay, I just do want to bring something up here. To be fair, he did actually auction off the first jacket.
That's true. He got
$1,800 for his charity. Chapel. So he didn't. He hasn't actually got a wardrobe full. He did have to go out and buy another one.
Well, that's right.
But, look, there's not many politicians who would feel free enough and comfortable enough in themselves to rock up in a leather jacket because it is basically a bit of a statement kind of going, I'm not wearing a suit. And I'm not wearing a safari suit, which is a shame. I think he'd rock a safari suit. So, some wag on the internet, I'd love to claim this is my own, but it's not that. But they said that the reason he turned up wearing a leather jacket was that he misheard the name of the program and thought that it was Q&A.
But I think that's a good
Fonzie
example.
Style.
Because he is wearing a designer jacket. So on one hand, you could say it has a sort of nod to the left or a nod to a maverick or renegade fashion sensibility, but it's the same as denim jeans. They have thousands of different meanings and they mean what the audience wants them to mean, and I think that it's a clever statement.
Q&A.
I know, isn't it brilliant?
Q&A. I saw someone tweet this week saying it looks like he's dressed for a rumble. I thought that was funny.
Mm. You're listening to The List on RN. I'm Cassie McCullough. With me is co-host Jason Gerosso. And also joining us from Melbourne is Dr. Lauren Rosewarne and Fiona Scott-Norman. Time now for obsessions. What's the thing that's got your goat this week? Lauren.
Likening women to animals. And we could have used the example with Julia Gillard's thighs, breasts, box, but we've had overnight Melissa McCarthy, the comedian, who was likened to a hippo by a New York Times reviewer.
Now, this is the star of Identity Thief, who's
Identity Thief, Bridesmaid, in a new movie,
with
Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Which I was almost, and we discussed this, almost going to talk about her being airbrushed within an inch of her life and having sort of 30 kilos removed from her from a movie poster. Instead, I really am getting concerned and tired of this likening of women to animals. It's a very, and I think it fits nicely with our week on gender and misogyny.
Fiona Scott-Norman?
Yeah, well, I suppose also fitting in with the motif of gender and misogyny, I am late to the Game of Thrones train. I finally got
late,
on
Fiona.
Board. Woo, woo! So I'm reading the books.
Winter's come and
gone.
Are you
reading
Winter's
the books?
Coming. Yeah, I know, because I'm old school.
No,
right?
that's very commendable.
So I was like, I'm halfway through the first book, so I've got a long way to go, yeah. And I am now into it. But when I first started reading it, I was really, really annoyed with it because it all is very much, all the women seem to be in very passive roles, you know, wandering around with their flaxen hair, being sold to dusky, threatening horsemen. And I found that when I started reading it, I was really angry about it because it just felt like same old, same old, same old tropes. It is changing now. I'm getting into it and I am starting to enjoy it. But I do find it interesting that something that is so popular does in fact tap into such classic gender roles where women do bup kiss.
Well, there might be a few surprises in store for you, I think.
Apparently.
But, you know, the Game of Thrones, sales of Game of Thrones have just shot through the roof in Australia because of what happened in the last 2 weeks of the show. People are turning to the books to find out what happens next. So interesting. Also, another book that's shot to the top of the bestseller list, I think it's number 6 on Amazon, is 1984, off the back of the Edward Snowden affair this week. Now, Jason DeRosso, to your obsession.
I've been checking out something you can do on YouTube. People put up isolated instrumental tracks from popular kind of pop songs. So you can, I've been having a look at some isolated bass tracks and drum tracks from Who songs. Which sounds really like a guy,
this is karaoke
thing,
for
daggy
one.
Guy thing to do, doesn't it?
I was about to say it sounds a bit nerdy, but go on.
Yeah, no, but it's really great. So you can kind of, yeah, I know. Like Johnny Entwistle playing bass on various songs. Just, but, you know, so if you ever wanted to hear him alone with all the other tracks stripped away, him and other musicians, I mean, there are various sort of things up on YouTube. Hours of fun.
Well, just finally, I'm reading at the moment Revenge Wears Prada, which is the sequel to The Devil Wears Prada by Lauren Weisberger. And I have to say, in the case of Fiona, the film was better than the book in the first instance. And I think that might be the case in the second time around, but I can't help myself. Uh-huh. Well, that's it. Thank you so much to Fiona and Lauren for being our guests today. Really appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Lauren Rosewarne is a senior lecturer at the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne, and Fiona Scott-Norman is a writer and comedian, and her most recent book is Don't Peek at High School. Well, that's it for The List this week. Don't forget you can visit our program page via abc.net.au/rn. Follow the links to The List.
Yes, where you can find all sorts of links that we put up each week relevant to the sort of things we're discussing in the show. And you can leave comments as well.
Don't forget you can also follow us on Twitter at @rnthelist. I'm Cassie McCullough. Time to go.
I'm Jason DeRosso. See you next week.
Newspapers, radio and TV overwhelm our underpants with fear. But how do we know what fear is the right fear to fear?
Are you ready?
Listen here. Hi, I'm comedian Dan Illick, and each Friday night in June, I'll be joined by some of Australia's best comedy brains on Irrational Fear. Here.
What station?
On RN. It's a fast-paced satirical comedy show. Imagine Q&A on crack. It's recorded in front of a live audience. For free tickets, look for Irrational Fear on the RN homepage.